All right, this morning we're going to be looking at a passage that certainly there is some dispute over concerning what exactly it's being talked about. And that is that there are going to be passages like that. Even among sound brothers in Christ, there's going to be some disputes. And one of the things that we should recognize, Alvin is here. Hello, Alvin. One of the things that we should recognize, there's an old restorationist motto. If and I know I've quoted it from the pulpit from time to time. It's been a while since I've done so, but it says, "In matters of faith, unity; in matters of opinion, diversity; in all things, love." And so, there are some things that we consider to be a matter of faith, that the Bible considers to be a matter of faith. Things that we must believe, surely must believe, and then some things that are matters of opinion, and then some things that are in any event, we need to treat each other with kindness and love. And so that's one of the great things about the scriptures, is that's the overarching theme of the scriptures, is love, as we talked about last week. So as we get into this, you may have a difference of opinion on some of the things that we talk about today, and I'll try to be clear about where things are more opinion based, and things are, and where things are more essential, and things are more in terms of an opinion. And so this is because this is a matter of prophecy. And the issue with trying to figure out what thing means what is sometimes difficult to ascertain, unless inspiration directly tells us that a particular thing means a particular thing. That's why there's so much dispute, and even in the religious world, about this particular passage and about many other passages in the scripture, because we don't have an inspired source to tell us, oh, this is the fulfillment of that. We do with most things in the Old Testament, but with many of the prophecies in the New, that is difficult to, again, difficult to ascertain. So in order to understand what some of these passages is talking about, some of these things that we're talking about, we have to have an understanding of history, and we have to have an understanding of the scriptures, because a lot of the things that are talked about uses biblical language, biblical prophetic language, in order to describe what we see in the in order to prophesy about particular things. So, there's in all of this, in all things, love is again the main point. And as we mentioned last week, we did broach this. We did mention and start talking about this last week. But one of the things that we want to make sure that we understand is the main point of this passage. And the main point comes in the last few verses of chapter 13. And the last few verses of chapter 13, verses 35 through 37, this is the main point. "Watch therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch." So we need to be ready for the coming of the Lord. We need to be ready at any moment. Now, if you believe that all of Mark 13 has already taken place in our past, this is still an applicable message for us today, and because it's a message that we find in other passages in the scriptures that clearly talk about things in our future. So, we need to make sure that we watch. We see that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, the idea of that thief in the night, the idea that we need to watch and be ready for these things. And so how do we be ready? Well, 2 Peter tells us what we need to do to be ready. And what manner ought you to live? Well, we need to live in holiness. We need to live in righteousness. That's 2 Peter chapter 3, I think around verse 10, 11, somewhere around there. So that is the idea. that we need to live righteous in any event. Because, well, even if the Lord does not return in our lifetimes, well, we don't know when our passing will be. How many people have you heard of who have died suddenly, who have died in a way that they, of course, never intended. There are people who live to the age that our brother Carl has lived, and then there are people who die in their 30s, so and even younger. So who knows what the future holds for us? And in any event, we need to be ready, whether for death or for the second coming of our Lord. So that's the main point I want to get across here for this. And last time I mentioned that there are, this is this Matthew 13 is has several parallel passages that we see in the gospel accounts. Matthew 24, there's Mark 13, Matthew 24, and Luke 21. All of these are talking about the same event. That well, all these are let me, all these are talking about the thing that. What's called the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus goes on to the Mount of Olives after a day of teaching in the temple that we see in Mark chapter 12, 11, and 12. And he goes on to the Mount of Olives and he tells his disciples about certain things that were going to happen in his future. And so, much of it is in our past. But some of it could very well be in our future. So let us consider some of the different opinions, or at least a brief overview of the opinions that I have on here. This is again, when dealing with these prophetic texts, and especially those that are eschatological, and that word means, it's a fancy word to describe study of the end times. Some people know what that means, some don't. But I want to, and we're going to be using a lot of language that may be unfamiliar to people in terms of labels. And I mentioned this again last week. That the labels that I think we need to use are not they are helpful in order to boil in order to address a particular view in a succinct way. We can't just say, oh, that view, this view. We can say use a particular label. And I know some people don't like labels, but I think that they're helpful. And we have a label, and that label is Christian, and that identifies who we are. Any other label, well, it helps us again to understand where we're coming from, and to understand what the scriptures are trying to say. And that's ultimately our goal, trying to figure out what the Bible, what God's word is trying to say. And trying to implement it and to apply it. So, looking at again Mark chapter 13, this is the again the word cloud for that. And we looked at that yesterday, and about the idea of that this we are in the era of the prophet right now, where Jesus is acting as a prophet. Well, he is a prophet, but he is fulfilling that role of prophet at this point. All right. So the temple's destruction. Again, there's some difficulties in interpretation. And let's see. Yeah, there are different ways to interpret what's called the Olivet Discourse. One is the idea that it's all future. That everything in this particular passage deals with future events. Now, I don't, and I mentioned this last time, this is, I think, an unsound view. I don't know of any brothers or sisters in the churches of Christ who hold that everything in the Olivet Discourse is speaks to a future event. And I think it's very clear that is not the case, particularly in verse 30. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all things take place. And so that is a view that I don't think that we can hold and still be faithful to the scriptures. There is another view, and I'm going to call this a what's called partial preterist. And I know that word preterist is not a word that we use in our everyday language, but it's an eschatological word to describe people who think that things took place in our past, that things have been fulfilled already. And partial means that part of it has been fulfilled and part of it hasn't. And so that I think is what I think most people in the churches of Christ that I've seen anyway believe concerning the Olivet Discourse. And so, yeah, most faithful brothers fall into this category. And again, I have a certain, the verse distinctions here on the one of the commentators I'm looking at holds that verses 5 through 31 have taken place in our past, and verses 32 through 36 take place in our future. You know, there's some dispute as to when things take place and where that dividing line is. And in fact, one of the commentators kind of divides it up, says, oh, this takes place in our future, this is in our past, this is in the future, this is in our past. So, you know, there's some different, there's plenty of opinions about what exactly these things mean. And of course, we're not going to be able to discuss every one of them simply because there's so many views, so many opinions about it. It's difficult to decide. It's difficult to look at all of them. There is another one that is the preterist view. There are faithful brothers that hold that the Olivet Discourse refers to things that have is everything in the past. Everything that we read in Mark 13 has already happened. And even so, we can still take application from many of the things that are in this passage to our current situation. Now, there is, and this is the idea of a preterist. So there's the futurist, which everything takes place in the future, partial preterist, which means some of it's in the future, some of it's in the past, and preterist, which means all of it's in the past. Now, the thing is, there is a section, I suppose, of people that have, I hesitate to say infiltrated the church, but there are some people who believe in that, who call themselves members of the Churches of Christ, who believe that that every bit of biblical prophecy has already happened. And that is not a sound position. There are it means that the resurrection has already happened. It means that the Lord has already returned. It means that everything has been burned up. And that is an untenable position. There are many things in the scriptures that, well, several things in the scriptures that have not already happened, and that is not a sound position. This is called full preterism, and this is not what we're talking about. There are faithful brothers who think that the Olivet Discourse has happened already in the past. Some that, but they don't think that everything in the scriptures has already happened. So there's that distinction. And so we need to make sure that we're not teaching what some have labeled Max King theory, because he's the one in the Churches of Christ anyway who's really been a proponent of that, or AD 70 theory, which is the idea that everything has been taking place in the past. The denominational world has a word for that, and I tend to, in order, especially in discussing with them, I tend to use their terminology, because they don't know who Max King is. And it's full preterism, and so we need to be careful whenever we teach things, because full preterism is outright false. And we see in 2 Timothy chapter 2 that there are some people who taught full preterism in the first century and overthrew the faith of some. And we need to be careful about that, making sure that we're not in that position. Oh, and I have that on here. Warning, some believe that all biblical prophecy has been fulfilled. This is not sound doctrine. This is not sound doctrine. Another, and you know, and I struggled with a label for this one because I just couldn't quite find a proper label. There are two other views of eschatology that I'm not going to get into too much, but I'm going to settle on this one, the historicist, the idea that it's sort of a mix between preterism, full, partial preterism, and historicism. This is the idea that some things take place in our future, some things take place in the past, and some are sort of a general thing that isn't necessarily talking about a specific event. And while that may be, we can, of course, look at get application. Even if things do take place in our past, we can get application from them. And as we go through this, hopefully that will be evident for us. Let's see, do I have? No, that's it. So I'm gonna go back, and so you can look at those particular things on the. So, and I have a label here for each of these positions. Are they sound? And whenever I go back, for some reason, it doesn't do the first one. The futurist position is unsound because of verse 30. The partial preterist and the preterist positions are held by sound brothers in other areas. And the full preterist, however, in all things, not sound. And I have some questions about whether or not the latter position is a sound one or not, but that's why I have a question mark there. I'm not sure. Because it's I've not encountered that before looking into this in a study. All right, so in order to understand, let's see, again, all this can be rather confusing, but recall the central message, watch, that we see in verses 35 through 37. At the same time, many of the things discussed in this chapter are very typical of persecutions against Christians. So again, we can still take modern application. We will consider primarily, again, the partial preterist and preterist positions here, especially since for many, the first 30 verses are not as much in dispute as to where they take place or when they take place. So that's the framework in which I hope that we can understand this particular passage. All right. Let us set the stage. So we're going to look right now at the first four verses of this particular chapter, the first four verses in setting the stage. Let us read. Then, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone shall be left upon another, and that shall not be thrown down." Now, as he sat on the temple, excuse me, as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?" All right. So Jesus and his disciples, they're done for the day and are heading back to their lodging in Bethany, via the Mount of Olives. So they're heading back to their lodging, whatever, wherever they're staying. Could be with Mary and Martha and Lazarus, could be with some others. We're not, or could be they could have rented a room by themselves. We're not sure. But that's where they're heading back. One of the disciples turns back and marvels at the site of Jerusalem and the temple complex that was below them. If you recall the video that we had when we went over Mark chapter 11, and started Mark chapter 11, and the and Jesus's march into the city. You might recall what that looked like, and in fact, I do have a picture of one of those things. This is a model of the this is a model of Jerusalem that is in Jerusalem, modern day Jerusalem, but a model of first century Jerusalem. Now, some of that to the right and is was not around during Jesus' time. It was built in the first century after Jesus, but of course the temple was around. And one might think that this was a view from the Mount of Olives. This is across that valley, that Kidron Valley, that is down below, that you might see over here. And of course, there's some walkway around here around this model. But one could imagine this is what the view is from the Mount of Olives. And looking at this beautiful temple that is on display here. Looking at this temple, again, it was quite a sight to behold. And it stretched out for 35 acres, 35 acres below them. The rabbis at the time were not fans of Herod. This is typically called Herod's temple, because he didn't build the temple itself, but he did build the temple complex around it and really built it up and made it quite a an amazing sight to behold. And so the rabbis, again, they were not fans of Herod, but in describing the temple complex that he built, they said, "He who has not seen Jerusalem in her splendor has never seen a desirable city in his life." Looking at this city, at this view, was an amazing thing. In fact, this wasn't limited to the rabbis. The Roman historian Tacitus even wrote that he was sufficiently pleased by the building to describe it as a temple of immense wealth. Wow, he called it a temple of immense wealth. Josephus recorded that the temple was built of hard white stones, each of which was about 25 cubits in length, for us, about 37 and a half feet in length, 8 cubits in height, which is about 12 feet, and 12 cubits in width, which is 18 feet. And we can find that in his book called Antiquities of the Jews, in book 15. And I have some references on here. You can look on the website if you're curious about the references for any of these quotes, or you can ask here you can ask here whenever you want. All right, so most of the stones that have been found weigh about 2 to 5 tons. Each with the largest weighing nearly 400 tons. These are huge stones. But Jesus turns around after being told, "Man, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here?" After being told this, he turns around and foretells the destruction of this same temple, something that would certainly occur in AD 70. At the hands of the Roman army. These facts are not in dispute. They sit and rest. The disciples sit and rest for a little bit before they move on along with Jesus. And then four of his disciples ask him about it. They're deeply concerned about when these things are going to happen. And four brothers are going to ask him. The four disciples who are, again, the first four who followed Jesus. The two sets of brothers, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. None of the other gospel accounts record this particular thing, but these are the disciples who ask Jesus about this. They ask about it privately, and it would appear that the other eight are not aware of what's going on here. All right. So, now we're going to lead up to the destruction. Leading up to the destruction. In the first, let's see, I've got the first verses 5 through 13 is the lead up to the destruction that I have here. And I doubt we'll get past that today. All right, first we have deception. So let's actually read this passage, verses 5 through 13. And Jesus answered them. Let's read the question first. Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? And Jesus answered them, and Jesus answering them began to say, Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and will deceive many. But when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be troubled, for such things must happen, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be earthquakes in various places, and there will be famines and troubles. These are the beginnings of sorrows. But watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils, and you will be beaten in the synagogues. You will be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all the nations. But when they arrest you and deliver you, do not worry beforehand or premeditate what you will speak. But whatever is given you in that hour, speak that. For it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Now brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And again, this is we can take application from this passage, even though this is talking specifically about the events leading up to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. We can certainly take application from this. This is what with that last verse there, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. You know, there are persecutions throughout history of Christians, and this would be comforting to them. I mean, this is recall, this was originally written to the Roman Christians. Let me do something with this line. It's getting really bright. These were originally written to Roman Christians. I mean, what use could the studying the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem help for the Roman Christians? Well, maybe there could be some help for them, maybe not. But we do know that it does that they were going to be undergoing persecutions, and that this would help them in that regard. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. This applies not only to the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem during this time, but also to Roman Christians when they are going to go through their persecutions. So this isn't limited. The lessons that we learn here are not limited to the specific time period that Jesus is referring to. Now, there will be deception. People claiming to be the Christ, as we see in verses 5 and 6. Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and will deceive many. Now, I think he mentions some of these things a little bit later on. We see that in verse 21 as well, and 22, and 23. So he says, then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or look, he is there, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. But take heed. See, I have told you all things beforehand. So again, the idea that, yeah, there's going to be deceptions, but don't pay attention to them. We see that in 2 Thessalonians with the great delusion that some people are going to be are going to fall for. And so again, that may have been applied to a particular time, but we can certainly take application from that because how many people are deluded today? Looking at these deceptions, I'd like to read some excerpts from Josephus, his work, The Jewish Wars or Wars of the Jews, to show the fulfillment of some of these prophecies that are talked about in this particular passage in the Olivet Discourse. As for these deceptions, we see in Book 2, Chapter 13, verses 4 and 5, or sections 4 and 5. These are really long, so I'm not sure they could be counted as verses. But this is how they've been divided. All right, so it says, there was also another body of wicked men gotten together, not so impure in their actions, but more wicked in their intentions. He's comparing these, what he's about to talk about, with the murderous Sicarii. Not sure how you pronounce that. I've only said, or seen it. I've only seen the word. I haven't heard it said. But they were a group of people who were murderous, who were wicked, and apparently impure in their actions. And so he's about to talk about some other people that could very well describe people who were deceitful. They were more wicked in their intentions, which laid waste the happy state of the city no less than these murderers, the murderous Sicarii. These were such men as deceived and deluded. These were such men as deceived and deluded the people under pretense of divine inspiration, but were for procuring innovations and changes of the government. And these prevailed with the multitude to act like madmen and went before them into the wilderness, as pretending that God would there show them the signals of liberty. But Felix thought this procedure was to be the beginning of revolt. Remember the governor Felix that we see in the book of Acts, the beginning of revolt. So he sent some horsemen and footmen, both armed, who destroyed a great number of them. But there was an Egyptian false prophet, and I think he's likely the man that Paul was thought to be in Acts chapter 21 and verse 38. The Egyptian false prophet, the Roman centurion or Roman commander, Lysias, Claudius Lysias, says, "Hey, I need to. Aren't you the Egyptian?" And Paul says, "No, I'm not an Egyptian." And so that's the same idea, the same person I think he's talking about here. But Josephus is talking about this. He says, but there was an Egyptian false prophet that did the Jews more mischief than the former, for he was a cheat and pretended to be a prophet also, and got together 30,000 men that were deluded by him. These he led around about, led round about from the wilderness to the mount, which was called the Mount of Olives, and was ready to break into Jerusalem by force from that place. And if he could once conquer the Roman garrison and the people, he intended to domineer over them by the assistance of those guards of his that were to break into the city with him. But Felix prevented his attempt and met him with his Roman soldiers, while all the people assisted him in his attack upon them, insomuch that when it came to a battle, the Egyptian ran away with a few others, while the greatest part of those that were with him were either destroyed or taken alive. But the rest of the multitude were dispersed, every one to their own homes, and there concealed themselves. So these Egyptians, or this Egyptian false prophet, he claimed to be somebody. He claimed to be, it doesn't say specifically he claimed to be the Christ, or that these people claim to be the Christ, but they claim to be prophets of some kind. And so people were following them. So again, this false prophet arose, many false prophets arose. Again, no doubt many claim to be the Christ, and that may be the case. And it would be easy for Jesus to do something like that because he had quite a following. People wanted to make him king. People wanted to put him up to that position, and it would have been easy for Jesus to have done that. But he had a great deal of humility and understood his purpose was not to overthrow through violent means the Roman overlords, but to die for the sins of the people, and to reign as king in the church and in the spiritual kingdom. In fact, today there are still people who claim to be the Christ. And one in particular is a man in Siberia who calls himself Vissarion. this is not a new thing, the idea of people claiming to be Jesus or the Christ in some way. It's been happening for a long time. It's not anything new. All right. So we got 5 minutes left. I don't think I'm gonna be able to get to the next section in just 5 minutes. Signs of the end, so is the next one. And that's sort of a question mark there, because some people like to use this passage very often to describe our world today. Signs of the end. The idea that verses 7 and 8, but when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be troubled, for such things must happen, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be earthquakes in various places, and there will be famines and troubles. These are the beginnings of sorrows. So what's being talked about here? The things that are listed in this passage, again, often cited about what would happen before Jesus comes. We might hear of all the terrible things going around in the world today, and we might think, and then someone says, so we might hear of all the things terrible happening in the world today, and someone else says that the rapture must be happening soon. Now, how many times have we heard that old yarn? And I grew up in a tradition, in a denomination that believed, oh, it's coming soon, and everything that we see in that's happening in the news is a sign of the end times. Well, how long has it been now? that's happening. It's coming right now. Now, I don't know when it's going to happen, so I can't pretend like I know that. It could happen soon. It could happen 1,000 years from now. I mean, who knows when it will happen? In fact, that's kind of the point that Jesus makes a little bit later. But what we see is, that's not what Jesus is saying here in verses 7 and 8. He's not saying that these are signs of the times. Jesus is reassuring his followers that wars, earthquakes, and famines are not essentially signs of the times. This is a common state of the world throughout time. There are always going to be wars and rumors of wars. When you study history, you see it is replete with wars and rumors of wars. You see, it's full of famines and earthquakes and all sorts of terribleness in that we have here. And in fact, the prophet Agabus prophesied of a famine that would occur and did occur in the reign of Claudius Caesar that we see mentioned in Acts chapter 11, verse 28. And I have that here for a reference if you're wanting that. Acts chapter 11, verse 28. This was prophesied, and Luke adds on a little bit later. Yeah, this took place during Claudius's reign. Claudius reigned from AD 41 to 54, which was around the time of Acts 18. And we see in Acts chapter 18 and verse 2 that Claudius is mentioned, that Aquila and Priscilla are kicked out of Rome because Claudius instituted an edict that would expel the Jews from Rome. And Aquila and Priscilla were Jews, Jewish Christians, sure, but they didn't make that distinction. And he was actually a sane emperor between two insane emperors, Caligula and Nero. Given all the terrible things that have happened in the world, all the earthquakes, wars, and famines, what makes our time so special? And I know it feels awful. It feels awful, this time that we're living in, but it really isn't that special. In fact, violence throughout the world has decreased significantly over the course of 100 years or so. It may not seem like it because we hear about all sorts of wickedness and evil. But truth be told, that is the statistic. That kind of thing is not as big of an issue as it once was. Now we hear about wicked and awful things happening, but they actually are happening much less frequently than they used to. I have on here, and I'll end. Ooh, wow. Okay. I don't know if I have time to look at that. This is a representation. So this is hard to see. This is a graph showing the earthquakes greater than 8.0 on the Richter scale recorded since 1900, when they first started recording these particular things. And the point that I want to get across here is not, oh, to look at these individual things and to study them, because I know you can't see them or it's very difficult for you to see, but to look at the frequency and look at the numbers and look at where they are. And I need to indicate what all these things are first. Again, it's hard to see. The year is on the vertical axis. So on the vertical axis, you see the year when these things happen. So at the top is 1900, and at the bottom is closer to our time period, our time where we're living now. The loss of life is indicated, excuse me, the magnitude of the earthquake is on the horizontal axis. So the weaker is over here, and the stronger is over here. The strongest appears to be in Chile in 1960 or so, a magnitude of 9.5, a Richter scale magnitude, and that's rough, that's awful. And the loss of life is indicated by the size of the circle. And continent is indicated by color. And so Asia is red. South America is green. Australia and Oceania is sort of a teal. North America is blue. Europe is purple. And Antarctica is on there, is black. Now, whatever earthquakes happen in Antarctica, no one cares because hardly anyone lives there. And no one would live there if there weren't scientists. So, there's that. No one would know that it was there. You see that biggest one that's right about here. If you might recall, the earthquakes in the Indian Ocean that caused the tsunamis that struck South Asia back in 2005. That was only about, I say only, it was pretty devastating. It says it's about 9.1 on the Richter scale, but a huge loss of life because of the tsunamis and the effect that that had. But of course, there are different things to consider. The world is more populated than it once was. So you will have more loss of life with whatever tragedy occurs. Our ability to measure them and report them is also greater. Think about that one in Antarctica that we see here in the 90s, the late 90s, apparently. I don't know how well you all can see that. So there's that. So note, Africa is not on here because Africa hasn't really had one in that's eight or higher on the Richter scale in the last 100 years or so, 120 years. So let's see. So you always wonder, is there a real increase or is it only because I'm hearing about it more? Have we defined these things differently? And of course, there are similar questions regarding famine. Jesus ultimately says, yeah, you'll hear about these things, but they're going to happen. Don't let it bother you. And strangely, this gives me a measure of peace. This gives me more peace than all the unrest would without his assurances. It means ultimately that our eschatology is not derived from the headlines. And that is the danger that many futurists have. The idea that, oh, this is a sign of the end. This is going to happen. And so you're all caught up in the news and in the headlines and saying, oh, this must mean this, this must mean that. The locusts are Black Hawk helicopters, as some people think, for some odd reason. So that is the danger that one runs into when they think that all this must be a future event that's being talked about. So we're out of time, and I apologize, I didn't get to Sam at all. The questions I had on here were at the tail end to ask him. So hopefully we can get to and see what thoughts he has about this next time. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I know it's a lot to talk about, a lot to go into, but it is, it's part of the Bible. And so we should do our best to try to understand it. And even some of the different opinions that might be on there. You may agree with all the opinions that we discussed here, you may not. But hopefully with new information, if any of this is new to you or new ways of thinking, then maybe you are better informed at the very least. All right. So thank you all for your kind attention. Lord willing, well, in a few moments, we'll have a new live stream for our worship service. So please join us for that. God bless you. Thank you for joining us.